So every time I'm asked this question, what is your religion? I'm thinking, oh my God, how I really hate this question. Just because I can't answer it. I can't answer it. What is your religion? Generally, unsophisticated minds tend to simplify things, you know, in order to be able to grasp things. So, you know, if it's a very complex, sophisticated, complicated, comprehensive, awesome thing, you just simplify it because you can't grasp it. Once it's simple, you have it under your grasp. It's under your control. You have a concept. You can deal with it. You can live with it. but that's a blunder. It does not do justice. It does not do justice. So, okay, let's say you answer that question by saying, you know, I'm a Hindu or I'm a Muslim or I'm a Christian or whatnot. Personally, to me, that hardly tells anything. Hardly tells anything. Because within every group of people, you'll find individuals on different levels of conscious development. And after all, the truth is a universal thing. So, what is your religion? I really like the way Krishna deals with it, specifically this case in the Bhagavad Gita, but elsewhere also. Rather than making divisions on some social grounds or cultural grounds or political grounds did I mention culture? Cultural grounds. he goes by something else. He divides it by quality. And grossly, Krishna divides people into four categories according to their spiritual conscious development. And those four categories are karmis, gyanis, yogis, and bhaktas. And I'm going to translate this into English in a sec. So, wherever you look, within every tradition, you'll always find these four categories. Could you write that on the board?
Right, the four categories.
Yeah. Do you need me to repeat it?
No.
Is that a permanent marker?
No.
Whatever. Sure.
It's a beach with water.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. It'll take a while to erase it. We use it every day. So,
you see that okay?
Yeah.
Can I make bubble letters?
That one's real thin.
Yeah, I got it right here.
Here's our regular.
I always carry a marker.
All right. To the rescue.
The thick.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could you erase that now?
With water, yeah.
Where's the eraser?
Oh, it come off? Well, this is a white erase.
Here's a little...
Is that a problem?
All right.
Go get some water.
All right. Here's what we're gonna do. You deal with that, and I'll deal with my thumb.
Okay, cool.
So maybe one point our roads may cross. Okay. So basically, it's very difficult to translate these four words into English because there's just no equivalent words for it, so we'll have to explain them. But before I move on to the four categories of religious or spiritual people, I should also throw in the materialistic group. In other words, group that's focused... Yeah, it's pretty good. That's fine. That's good, like that. Thank you. We may need your services later again, I'm not sure, but if you could be close by. All right, this is getting interrupted. So besides these four, they're preceded by the materialistic group. Now, materialists... people become materialists. I picked three reasons, and these are the three reasons that Krishna also lists. We could I guess, throw in some more, but I think these are three major ones. First one is sensual sedation. One, it's simply sedated by sensual pleasure that does not bother to inquire about the principles behind the details that we see running around. So one is simply satisfied. One sacrifices the philosophical inquiry for the sake of sensual gratification.
What's wrong with that?
I didn't say anything's wrong with that. I'm just saying, throwing the list in. Though I do think it's an underdevelopment, conscious underdevelopment. But we'll leave plenty of time at the end for a discussion. That's one class of materialists. So they're just satisfied with the gross physical world that's around them, and they try to avoid the pain and embrace the pleasure. Whatever feels pleasing to the sensual experience, including the mental sensual experience, he or she will embrace, endeavor for, become attached to, and whatever's sensually, including the mind, displeasing tries to squeeze out of one's conscious experience. The other group are those who have become materialists by philosophical progress. In other words, looking out into the world, gathering information about the world, one has concluded that everything is pointless. We live just for some time, and after we expire, and that's about it. And because we expire, after our expiration, we do not exist, so therefore everything is pointless. So, yeah, it's all pointless. So might as well squeeze some pleasure before it happens, and that's about it. And that's one category. There are also folks who, I guess the third category would really refer to personal aspect of God. In other words, this category would involve God. Now we're not dealing just with the general sphere of the spiritual realm. So these are the folks who, upon having been presented the concept of a personal God, feel very much decentralized. You know, there's this big personality that's categorically, always, eternally superior. That just doesn't sound right. I don't like that. Okay, I don't like it. And for that reason, they will abandon that. So that's the materialistic realm. Then over on the spiritual realm, we start to make a gradation. And begins with we have it up there, karmis. Now, karma means to work, to act. And karma, of course, in Vedic philosophy, you do not make the blunder of separating an action from its reactions. Because every time you want to comprehend an action, you do have to include the consequences of that action. Otherwise, you really have no clue what the action is. So therefore, karma does not only involve an action, but also involves the reaction to the action. Then you have a complete package, complete understanding of that activity. So therefore, karmis, in this particular term here, refers to those who are motivated by fruitive activities. In other words, they purposefully perform activities which will then produce a fruit, and specifically will produce a material fruit. Therefore, you'll find a great deal of pious, for the most part, good people, who will pursue spiritual or religious path in order to satisfy their material needs. So they'll come to a temple, mosque, church, whatnot, in order to satisfy their material needs. That's the way. Basically, sometimes they're considered materialists also. So you can't really tell where they're at, whether they're on the spiritual or the materialistic side. Because on the materialistic side, people are getting their pleasure by any and all means, whatever works, doesn't matter. And on the over, when the same folks move over to the religious realm, then they go about satisfying their material needs in religious ways. So they'll approach God, deity, goddess, whatnot, gods, statue, whatnot, prayer, with this idea that you provide for my material needs. And if their material needs are not being provided for, they'll have a crisis of faith. What happened to God now? You know, like, you know, my house got crumbled. Tank ran through it. Crisis of faith. We often even see here, people come and pray for health, pray, oh God, help my children pass their exams and become educated and get good jobs and healthy. And that's exactly what my grandmother prays every night and every morning. Maybe that's why I'm in a good health. She prays for all of her children and grandchildren. God, please protect them. Give them strength, health, wealth. These folks also, not always, but tend to be polytheistic. And we totally find this within, nearly within every tradition in the world. Because out of a fear for maintenance, people tend to approach these deities that are in charge of natural powers. So they feel they're connected. They have a say in the decision-making process about their faith, about the future. So sacrifice a virgin, throw her into a volcano pit. So, I mean, these are real examples, you know. So that we be protected. I mean, people. To me, that's very unsophisticated. And it's based on this fear, fear for maintenance. Within Hinduism, we have crores, that's a Hindu word. You have millions of people worshipping demigods, demigoddesses, different deities, simply for this purpose. Appease them so that, you know, we be protected, we be maintained, and we be materially safe and secure. You find this in Scandinavia, you find this everywhere. Different personal or impersonal natural powers, we try to appease them. So we feel like there's some connection. It's not that someone else or something else is making decisions about my life, but rather now I have a say in the decision-making process. You know, I sacrifice a virgin and, or whatnot. You know, offer prayers or sacrifice a goat or, give some money. Many people come here. They put some money in the donation box thinking, now give some money to the God and once I walk out of here, there'll be prosperity. So those are karmis. They'll do charitable work. They'll open up hospitals. They'll feed the poor. For this reason, I'll do good, and the good will come my way. And their idea of good is always centered on the physical identity, that I'm this physical product, namely the body, and the highest good, highest benefit, is to have this body comfortable. And that's why they practice religion. So next we move to the second group, the jnanis. Jnana means knowledge. And jnanis or intellectuals are the people who gave it a little more thought. Let's say they went over the obstacle that, you know, once the body is terminated, you are terminated, and therefore everything is pointless. They rather go out the way around about it. They think, if when the body is terminated, everything is over, then nothing makes sense. If nothing makes sense, then what's the point of it all? However, intuitively, we all feel that there's some value to our existence. If there is value to our existence, then our existence must have a purpose. But for an objective purpose to exist, you have to continue to exist. You absolutely have to continue to exist. And this brings people to the spiritual realm. And jnanis tend to identify themselves not with the body, not with the physical body, but they think themselves rather in spiritual terms. And therefore, it's a completely new ball of game. They tend to be sophisticated thinkers. They thought about life. Pleasure is not necessarily greatest motivation in their life, but rather the truth. You know, things that make sense. You know, the world that's consistent. That's what motivates them. Jnanis usually seek mukti. Or mukti in Sanskrit terminology means liberation. The experience in this world, and many people think like this, I have, you know, my personal existence involves experience of pain and pleasure. And I don't seem to be able to separate the two. To every pleasure, some pain is attached. Every pain is followed by pleasure, and every pleasure is followed by pain. And darn, you just can't separate the two. So they completely move away from that realm. And therefore end up with the idea of just give me liberation. And the idea of liberation is in impersonal terms. That my very nature is not personal, because, you know, person right now involves pain, so the solution is impersonal. The solution must be impersonal. They tend to be detached and rising above the dualities of illusion. And if you read, for example, they tend to be detached from the world, you know, from material pleasure and material pain. They tend to regard them both equally. Equally as illusory. So they don't endeavor for material pleasure, neither they're trying to avoid material pain. But the main aspect, the main quality of this group of people is they have detected the two clearly separated realms. You know, the physical realm and the metaphysical realm. They have detected the two by the intellectual, pursuing the intellectual path. Next, we move on to the yogis. Now, yoga involves a process. In order to know about things, we need to know how things exist. Like, I'll give you an example. If you want to measure distance, you can't do that with a thermometer. Yeah. So you need to know something about space in order to comprehend it. Okay. So, how does this apply over here? When it comes to the metaphysical realm, you cannot use measuring tools you otherwise used in the physical realm. So you can't use the tools for comprehension of the gross physical realm to comprehend the metaphysical spiritual realm. You need a new set of tools. You need different processes. And that's where the yoga begins. So yogis tend to be mystics. They call them mystics. And Srila Prabhupada said that mystical means just for you, means you don't know. So it's all mystical. There's nothing mystical about something that you do know. But it's mystical to a materialist because materialists has never come to deal with these tools and these processes for detection of the metaphysical realm. Just like the fellow who lost his keys, he was drunk. And he was trying to get into his house, and he dropped his keys. And then he went over to the pole nearby where there was a light. And he's searching for his keys there. "What are you doing, sir?" "Searching for my keys." "Well, where did you drop him?" "Over there." "Why are you looking here?" "Well, there's light here." "Here I can see." So people make the same blunder, you know. They try to apply their, you know, physical tools in the metaphysical realm. It doesn't work. So that's where the yoga begins. And you'll find yogis in many different traditions. So they're mystics. And here, yoga literally means to connect. And because they have started to use metaphysical tools for detecting metaphysical realm, they're starting to develop relationship with God. Because detection of the person of Godhead, the personality of Godhead, has started. But it's just the beginning. It's just the beginning. So there is, you know, the relationship is somewhat passive. That's a yogi. And that then moves us over to the realm of bhaktas. You know, bhakti means devotion or love. And bhaktas are ones who have developed relationship with God. There's a genuine, loving relationship. Now, here in the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, which is our lineage, in the International Society of Krishna Consciousness, which is our institution, we practice bhakti. However, we find a very few bhaktas. Very few bhaktas. Because it takes a great deal of sincerity to become a bhakta. Most people may even intellectually understand, maybe on the platform of jnanis, let's say, and they understand the difference between spirit and matter. And many folks tend to forget that all the time. But then psychologically, they're materialists. They're always fearing for the physical frame. They don't have realization that I'm a spirit soul, immortal, indestructible, you know, which is the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. They thoroughly fear. They're totally motivated by fear. And they experience crisis of faith when there's discomfort to the body, let alone that the body is like thoroughly hurt. Where's God now? Ah! That's the outlook of a materialist. Materialist identifies oneself with the physical body. And over here you have jnanis who are totally in a different category. Yogis who are starting to establish a relationship with Krishna, with God. And then ultimately there is development of love of God, which is the category of the bhaktas. Now, the symptom of love, even in this world we see, first of all, people have a very difficult time. Can I have your watch? Or your iPod? Do you have your clock time? First of all, people have a very difficult time distinguishing lust from love. There's like different gradations of lust, and people often consider that love. Scratch my back, I scratch yours, and we call that love. Often sexual-based relationships are based on a doctor-patient relationship. you know, she, you know, she needs someone to encourage her, to be there, to, you know, give her support in this, you know, otherwise very difficult place called the physical realm. And then he plays the role of a doctor, you know, and he pats her on the back, and then everything is okay. The relationship goes on, and then the roles switch. You know, he goes out to make some money, maintain the family. You know, dealing with a rough business world where there's backstabbing taking place every second, politics and so on, and it's very discouraging. And what he needs is, when he comes home, is that she says, "Oh, my dear prince, how are you? You look powerful and mighty. And how was at work?" And kiss, you know, how, you know, let me fix your tie. I fixed the dinner for you. He feels important. He feels encouraged. So he can go out there and, you know, battle the evil forces again. Now, what happens is, when they're both patients, the relationship breaks apart. Or if they're both doctors trying to instruct. So that's not love. That's not love. That's just a that has some resemblance of love. That's about it. So love is not motivated. There's no motivation. Love is just out of pure, spotless attraction. And this is attraction that comes intrinsically. In other words, you're categorically meant to be attracted. Like the soul's attracted to God, the soul's attracted to soul, the soul's attracted to service, to offer service to God, to another soul. Pure, unmotivated. We're hardwired, at least according to the Vedic texts, to be like this. And this is our natural position. That's love. Everything below that point is a compromise. And starts moving over towards the category of lust. Krishna bhakta nishkama ata eva shanta. Bhukti mukti siddhikami sakaliya shanta. That those who are bhaktas, those who have come to the point of being pure lovers of God, they're peaceful, shanta. Why? Because they have nothing else to achieve. They're okay. We find in those of you who have read Srimad Bhagavatam, there's so many prayers of saints, saintly people, men and women, who did remarkable services and sacrifices for God, for other people, and so on. And when asked in return, "What can I do for you?" "Well, nothing. Just give me another opportunity for service." That's love. Now, I know very few people are like that. Very few people. Okay, no problem. We don't have to be discouraged. But we should at least know real from fake, and try to initiate the process out of the fakeness, artificiality, towards the real stuff. So because bhaktas have nothing to attain, I don't care about, that's it. I just, one thing I want. Nadanam najanam nasundarim kavitam va jagadisha kamaye. I have no desire. I don't want any followers. I don't want, this is a male person saying, I don't want a, you know, beautiful girl to encourage me, blah, blah, blah. I don't want anything. I do want one thing, you know, an opportunity for service. just that. And bhukti mukti siddhikami sakaliya shanta. And those who are bhuktis, those who aspire for you know, material acquisitions, those who aspire for liberation from material discomfort, those who aspire for yogic siddhis or yogic mystic perfections, because by practicing yoga you can develop powers that contradict the physical laws, which is very attractive. all these people are restless. They're not peaceful people because they're motivated, and therefore they're immoral. Ultimately, they're immoral. They have an agenda. They have an agenda. And as long as there is agenda, we can occupy the rest of the world. The same program is going to go on. Talk about the occupiers. So, therefore, Krishna in the Srimad Bhagavatam, pure bhakti or pure love of God is defined as savai pumsam parodharma. Dharma is like the intrinsic quality of something, a quality that sustains something, existence of something. Like water is liquid. If you remove liquidity, then the water doesn't exist. So dharma refers to something, to the quality that that sustains, makes existence of the thing possible. So what is the parodharma? What is the ultimate dharma, the ultimate nature, the deepest, most nature of the self, of the living entity, it's stated. Yato bhaktir adokshache. And this is bhakti, devotion towards adokshache, which is another name for God. And ahaituki apratiyata. It is unmotivated. There's no motivation. I don't do this because I'm going to walk out of fear and when I get home there'll be, you know, a suitcase full of money or whatever, or my husband won a lottery or some, you know, some material thing landed on my head. Maybe a cinder block. Just it's unmotivated. It's simply out of love, that's all. And it's simply for that, period. Nothing else. And it's apratiyata, ahaituki, and apratiyata, it's uninterrupted. We may occasionally have these spiritual, pure spiritual experiences where we see ourselves as a pure spirit soul and we don't care about, you know, the body, the physical stuff, and all we want to do is just serve God, you know. And in those moments we just feel very blissed out. But then we come down. We make the comeback over to the lower realms of conscious development. So real bhakti is unmotivated and it is uninterrupted. That is the definition. So just this morning we read something and I printed it here. I'd like to read to you two verses from the Srimad Bhagavatam on this topic. Any person, whether man or a woman, who worships me with loving devotion, offering his or her prescribed duties, in other words, everything that you do, unto me without material attachment, is understood to be situated in goodness. Then the contrast to it is, when a person worships me by one's prescribed duties with the hope of gaining material benefit, his nature should be understood to be in passion. That's a particular quality of existence, which I'm not going to explain right now, but it's a lower quality. And one worships me with a desire to commit violence against others is in ignorance. Have we not seen this in religious realms of all traditions? So what is my religion? What in the world is my religion? And what if I say Hindu or Vaishnava or Gaudiya Vaishnava? You know, what does that tell you? Very little. Very little. Whoever asked that question, I hope you don't get offended, but most likely that often question in itself reveals ignorance. So this question to me reveals ignorance of what is actually spiritual or what is actually religious. And I'll just end with a quick analysis of the motivation with which people who have come to the spiritual or religious realm operate. This is according to Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, 19th century saint. 20th century saying. First he said, there are people who approach religion out of fear. And we sort of covered that, you know, tend to be polytheistic, this, that, or even jnanis tend to be afraid of the physical realm, of the personal existence. And anything done out of fear is very rudimentary. It's gross. It's unsophisticated. It's nearly animalistic to act out of fear. And actions born in the space of fear don't tend to be sophisticated. The next one is out of duty. That one has realized, one is not, we'll see how the motivation is becoming purer. Over here you have a totally selfish thing. You're freaked out of your mind and you need protection, so you go to some kind of a deity. That will give you some kind of solace. So it's not, you're not approaching deity for the deity's sake. You're approaching deity for your own sake. That's called using. I'm using you to, you know, you'll become means to my own ends. That's immoral. And it's impure. Then out of duty is that one has realized that I actually owe so much to Krishna. I owe so much to the holy people who taught me the science of Krishna consciousness, God consciousness. And I'm thinking of this in very universal terms. I really owe. And out of duty, one will engage in some kind of preliminary loving activity to reciprocate the goods. And that's much better. I know in India, a lot of people act with this motivation. And then the pure religion begins at the platform of love. That there's a pure, spontaneous attraction, love of God, where I do not want anything in return. So this is a lofty goal for most of us, and it's the only goal worth striving for, as it's stated in the Bhagavatam, yayatma suprasidati. That there is no other thing that can ever satisfy the self. You know, once you pull out of this only pure loving relationship, wherever else you try to connect, hook up, it's going to always be short. It's going to always be a doctor-patient relationship or some kind of other, you know, economic-based relationship. And therefore, because it's impure, it's not satisfying. Impurities are annoying. So that's the only thing that can ever satisfy the self. Therefore, the bhaktas are shanta, they're peaceful. They have no needs to fulfill. And it's a lofty goal. But it's the only thing worth striving for, really. Everything else is just, as Srila Prabhupada said, gave the analogy of a person who's carrying a load on one's left shoulder, and when it gets tired, shifts the load to the right shoulder, says, oh, feels much better. Continues to carry the same, all right, I'm not going to use any profanities, but same, you know, rocks, whatever. Same poop. You know. And our solutions, every solution short of the bhakti solution is like Prabhupada gave another analogy of jumping out of a frying pan into the fire. It's like, oh. it's just a different kind of nastiness, you know. Different kind of imperfection. So I'll stop there, and at this time we can entertain questions or comments. Yes.
Focus is in the sincerity that someone has in trying to develop the relationship with God, and thank you for your discussion on those different levels. But might it not be useful or intelligent for someone to ask about someone's religion, because with that they learn the process by which they're trying to connect with God?
May not or may be. Sorry, I didn't I missed a word there. So I'm not sure which way you went.
Okay. I'm saying, might it be useful.
Oh, might it be useful? Yeah, yeah,
you know,
of course.
Intelligent,
yeah.
To inquire, not so much as to evaluate whether or not that person is, you know, fully developed in their spirituality, but what their approach or their process is to understand, okay, how are they trying to connect with God? What is there?
You're totally right, yeah.
Can you summarize that question?
Oh, yeah. She said that there is validity to the question, what is your religion? Because, for example, in ISKCON, in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we know what the goal is. Well, at least I hope so. At least it's written in the books. Hope you guys all read it. It's bhakti. So that tells you something about the process. So you certainly can learn something. That's for sure. But for example, if someone tells me something so broad as, let's say, I'm a Christian, to me that says close to nothing. Honestly, I mean, like, I read once a book. I actually recommend it. You can read it. It's called The Way of a Pilgrim. It's a famous book by an unknown Russian author, translated into many languages, including English. That's how I got to read it. And I was this person was chanting his Christian prayer, you know, and very much reminded me of the chanting that we do on the beats. He also had his own beats, prayer beats, you know. And and then as he goes on about this process year after year, and he's writing his realizations, I mean, shook me to the core. His realizations were identical to the realizations I have had. And not only that they were identical, but they were identical in the sequence in which they occurred. It was just absolute. And he himself, I mean, took a distance from the institution, you know, from the church, because, you know, the local church was corrupted, blah, 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 you know, which is very often the case, you know. People get materially motivated, and another book I just read by Tolstoy, Father Sergius or Sergei, great example of it, like that. And I also met, you know, Christian and Hindus who I would never associate with. So gross, you know. You know, their understanding of what the world is and how they should relate to it is just pathetic. So maybe such a, you know, like a really general term as a Christian, because that's a very wide, you know, or a Hindu. I mean, that, to me, that doesn't say much. Doesn't say much. There's so much within that, you know, so-called Hindu realm, you know. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So what I was, I mean, not that I'm trying to negate what you're saying, but I really wanted to look at that question from this other perspective, you know.
Yeah, no, the quality.
Correct, yeah.
And not just naming it as just some kind of cultural identification.
Yeah, and then when someone asks me that question, and I give that person the answer, you know, and then that person will superimpose over me all the misconceptions that person has about the name I used. Correct, yeah. Even the question, do you believe in God, you know? I mean, what's your concept of God? You know, or like some people say, I don't believe in God. And I say, yeah, you know, tell me what your concept of God is. I probably don't believe in that concept myself. You know. I mean, just the other day that happened to us, that's why I was motivated. Walking down the alley, what's your religion? Are you religious, you know? What's his concept of religion? And he obviously had a, you know, like, idea that religion is something bad. Says who? I mean, what, you know, what's your understanding of the word religion, you know? And clearly person is trying to comment on a book he didn't read. In other words, he's trying to talk about religion and never practiced anything, clearly never did any study of it. You know, let alone went deep into it, you know, to understand that there are divisions, you know, that there's objective conscious development, you know. And he was going to paste, you know, superimpose over me all these posters that he has in his mind of what religion is. I said, no, thank you, I'm not going to answer that. You know, unless you're ready to, you know, sit down and talk, like, you know. Okay, so we had one there and then one over here.
Yeah, you mentioned dharmas.
I mentioned what?
Dharma.
Dharma, okay.
Which are teachings of Buddhism?
No, I didn't use dharma in that sense.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that's what you said.
Yeah, I defined it as a quality that sustains existence of something.
Okay, I misunderstood.
Yeah, no problem. We're done? Okay. Then we have one here, and then Coral. Is that right? Yeah, I think at least I saw his hand first, then Coral, and then we'll end there if you don't mind, because we have to move on, going over time.
I'm just wondering, Sanatan Dharma, which is Sanatan means eternal, are these divisions, I think you use the word division or category, are the divisions of that Sanatan Dharma?
Yes. Yeah. Sanatan Dharma refers to the last development of purity, that's bhakti. And if you think of purity, pure means that you eliminate all that which is not the thing. Like pure water means water without any additions. So pure soul means soul without any artificial designations, no artificial add-ons. And basically that's the process. You just do away with everything which is not the thing. And that's called Sanatana Dharma, or the eternal quality. And Coral?
I just wanted you to clarify a little bit more. So you talked a little bit about lust and relationships from a materialist point of view, but from a bhakta point of view, they become transcendental. The same relationships can then be full of service or someone to that you see Krishna in, or that's always reminding you of Krishna, right?
Yeah, the difference in a pure relationship would be that, we're all in times of, because we're not the energetic, we are energy. And therefore, we do need protection. And therefore, we do need encouragement. Therefore, we often find ourselves in the position of a patient. So, you know, I didn't mean to say that that's like completely... Whatever's happening in whatever we see in existence, the Vedic understanding is it's good in its own pristine form. It's not that we find here and now is illusory. It may just be contaminated. So whatever we find in existence, be sure that there is a pristine form of it, the pure form of it. So we do need encouragement. We do need support. We do need friends. We do need partners. But until we come to the platform of a bhakta, self-realized person, you know, transcending the physical consciousness that makes you always fearful of your own body, you know, including the mental body, you know, we're always going to remain imperfect. And therefore such relationships never really work. And we should... You know, our tendency is to get accustomed to the presence of ignorance, you know, but we should never be satisfied with ignorance. And that means living in some discomfort. You know, you're living with something that you don't like about yourself. We should look at it from another perspective. Dissatisfaction is the basic inspiration for progress. Because when you're satisfied, you don't want to go anywhere. You don't want to change. And therefore, people, you know, when they detect ignorance, when they detect incoherence, when they detect inconsistency, you know, they just sort of learn to live with it, you know, sort of learn to be obtuse to the ignorance, you know. But no, we should never allow it. That's prostitution of our own self. You know, what's ignorant is ignorant. We should detect it, recognize it, and not be happy about it. And that in turn should motivate us to, you know, move towards improving. You know, but, you know, there's another inconsistency called the pride, the false ego, you know, where we like to feel like we're perfect, powerful, and happy. and therefore, you know, we tend to, like, close our eyes, you know, toward the ignorant thing. So, there's lots going on. Yeah. So it's okay. I mean, I mean, I know, and those who know me, they also know, you know, even after speaking all this, I'm a very imperfect person, you know. And, you know, but I'm not depressed about it. And as a matter of fact, it's, to me, it's an encouragement to move on. One of the symptoms of one who's seriously treading the spiritual path is humility. Trinadapi sunichena tarodiva saishnana amanina manadena. You know, amanina, not thinking of oneself in too great of terms, you know, but and always ready to offer respect to others. Also something that takes practice. Is that okay? Thank you. Unless it's like really burning. Okay, this is the last one for sure.
Okay. What was the name of the book you said you read?
I mentioned two books. The Way of a Pilgrim, and I meant by an unknown author.
The Way of a Pilgrim.
Yeah. If you email me, I'll email you. Maybe even a link where you can download it. It's within the public domain. You can download it for free. Okay, thank you for your attention. I'd like to request everyone to please rise, and if you could help us drop these mats off in the corner here, then we'll do our kirtan. Thank you.